You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Goldhawk Fights Back for You on AM 740 Zoomer Radio. Goldhawk Fights Back for You airs Monday to Friday, 11 to 1 on AM 740 Zoomer Radio.
Time enough, I think, at 19 minutes after 12 to call in the doctor, and that's Dr. Zachary Levine. Hi, Dr. Zach.
Hi, Dale.
I know that today I'm checking the medical chart here in terms of the menu of things to be talked about today. Urological problems, I guess, is the general theme, including such things as incontinence, infections, and, of course, some discussion of the prostate, of prostate problems. Where would you like to start on this?
Well, you know, we got to talking about this topic after I got an email from you guys about the new laser treatments that they're using for prostate, basically mostly for enlarged prostate, which is an issue of that men have, and most men get it at some point in their lives as a risk factor. Certainly just as we get older, it gets more common. And in the past, what urologists have always done is something called a TURP, which is a transurethral resection of the prostate, which is basically they go in through the penis, through the urethra, and they use something like either an electrical loop, or they use something where they can basically dig away at the area. It's almost like Roto-Rooter, where there's a tube and there's something impinging on the tube, and you're just trying to open up the tube from
the
inside.
Boy, you sure know how to sell a medical procedure, let me tell you.
Thank you. But anyway, now, as of recently, they're using laser treatments.
Yeah.
And actually, I didn't know that much about it, so I read a bit about it, and I spoke to some urologist friends, and it sounds actually to be very, very promising, and to have a lot less of the bleeding and incontinence type of side effects that were being experienced a lot with the previous methods of opening up the tube.
Now, this is for a condition known as benign prostatic hyperplasia. This has nothing to do with prostate cancer, right?
That's exactly right.
All right.
So this is just, in many men, the prostate just grows over the years. And it grows, the prostate surrounds the urethra, which is the tube that brings urine from the bladder to the outside world. And as it grows, it can squeeze the tube. So basically, you can have sometimes it can eventually progress to a complete blockage, but usually it's somewhat obstructed. So men have difficulty getting the same kind of stream that they used to have in terms of strength. They may not be able to fully empty their bladder. And so in the past, they've used the other methods that I mentioned to try and open up the flow, whereas now they're using this. But it is important that you make the distinction, because prostate cancer as well can make the prostate grow, and it can also cause similar symptoms. So that's why you do have to see a urologist and be properly investigated and diagnosed.
To know which kind of situation you have, right?
Exactly, because if it is a prostate cancer, then they often need to take out the whole prostate. And in addition, they do indeed have to take biopsies often at the beginning to make sure that there's not a cancerous component.
Okay. But if the doctor's just doing the TURP operation, the older operation that's now being replaced by a laser therapy, in that situation, they didn't have to take out the whole prostate. They just took out some of it to make it smaller? Was that the idea?
Yeah, exactly. They would just go in through the middle of it, through the urethra, and they would open up the part that surrounds the tube, the urethra, and they wouldn't necessarily have to take out the entire prostate.
Why does the prostate grow when we get older?
Well, it just grows. I mean, there's a few different influences on the prostate, and one of them is hormones, and that's why there are a couple of medications that are used for benign prostatic hyperplasia, including Proscar and Flomax, which we can talk about. And basically what happens is there's some hormonal influences, and these hormones tell the prostate to keep on growing, even though it doesn't necessarily have to for us to function well. And so just with time, it just gets overgrown and starts to obstruct the tube that it surrounds.
And at that point in our lives, older men don't really... You don't really need your prostate then, do you?
You don't really. I mean, to be perfectly honest, I mean, you may, we could always ask a urologist about this, but to be perfectly honest, I'm not sure we need it ever all that much. You know, it secretes a little bit of fluid, which is somewhat helpful, but it's not really one of these organs that, it's not in the... not on the level of the heart or the brain, let's say.
Right, of course. Now, and so with this laser treatment, the laser does the same thing that the physical operation would do, reduce the size, make a little more room for proper urination, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So they still go up through the urethra, and the laser, what happens is there's a couple of different types of lasers. I mean, it sounds like there's something called the green light laser and the holmium laser. They both work the same way, but one is a little bit more powerful. The holmium is usually reserved for very large prostates. They measure the prostate by in grams, and so holmium is usually used for prostates greater than 70 grams, and the green light is used for smaller prostates like between 20 and 60 grams. And they go up through the urethra, and they use the laser, and then basically it disintegrates the tissue in its way. Now, they have a cystoscope, so they see what they're doing. It's not a blind operation. They look up, they see the area that needs to be cleared out, and it basically disintegrates it. And one of the things that it does, though, it coagulates at the same time. So rather than having bleeding afterwards, it actually stops the bleeding as it does its procedure. And so that's one of the advantages of this, is that, first of all, it's faster. Second of all, you don't have as much bleeding and side effects. And the other thing is that oftentimes you don't have to keep a catheter in as long. Sometimes people go home the same day with no catheter, but more often they might have to keep the catheter in just overnight as opposed to 3 or 4 days.
And it would in some cases prevent the kind of incontinence that might be associated with a TURP procedure. Is that fair
exactly.
to say?
I mean, I actually asked one of my urologist friends, like, why aren't they doing this all the time, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, if it's so great, and they seem quite excited about it, the urologist, and he said, well, basically, it's still, the laser is, because it's new, it lacks the same kind of long-term data, you know, the long-term studies that the TURP has. But in the short term, what they found over the past few years since they've been doing it, it does have less side effects, and including one of the big side effects from TURP and also from any kind of prostate surgery is erectile dysfunction and incontinence. Those are two of the big ones. And the studies so far do indicate that using the laser does decrease the risk of having those side effects.
Are urologists ever hopeful that someday that same kind of laser technology could be used to operate on prostates that are cancerous?
I think
is
so.
That a way to go, I wonder, someday, way in the future, maybe?
I mean,
maybe
from the sounds of it, the people I spoke to, they're really excited about it. And I think, and more, as I'm sure you and the listeners know, we're heading towards minimally invasive surgeries. You know, instead of the big cuts and the big scars that many people have from when they went out in the past, they took out their appendix or they took out their gallbladder. These days, it's all done laparoscopically. If they can. I mean, we still have to do big cuts sometimes.
Yeah.
But they're trying more and more to do things either laparoscopically or using laser where they don't have to have a big incision and the healing time is much faster. And so I'm sure they are looking at whether they can do a total prostatectomy in this method.
Well, it's true, isn't it? I mean, especially in days of old in the medical profession, a patient spent as long recovering from the operation as from the condition.
Oh, for sure. I mean, and many surgeries now that are day surgeries used to be hospital admissions for a week.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, here's Jerry on the line with the question. Jerry, go ahead, please.
Yes, gentlemen. Good morning.
Hi.
Very enthusiastic this topic, and I'm speaking from some experience both as a medical lab technician and as a patient. I must say that if by chance the best way to remove this urine from your system is forget about standing up, because that requires balance, and every time you rotate around, obviously the muscles go in spasm and then it stops the flow.
Okay.
If by chance you would sit down and relieve yourself that way, it is much easier to control your balance, and therefore consequently it's easier to remove the fluid. No one has ever thought about that, and I got the tip years ago from a urologist.
Oh, yeah.
Working in the medical lab, and it has helped me immensely, and I have no drugs, no side effects, no problems, and I don't have any problem sleeping. And because of the simple reason that it removes the system fluid.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? If you can't get the urine out of your bladder, you're going to wake up in the middle of the night and you're going to spend a lot of time in the bathroom. That's the problem, isn't it?
Well, primarily, but if you don't empty the fluid out, it's going to cause you that grief.
Yeah.
And standing up is not the way to go.
Okay, all right. I hadn't heard that. Had you heard that, Dr. Zach?
Well, I have actually had patients tell me that they're sometimes by sitting and even sometimes crouching, leaning forward, they can increase pressure somewhat. You know, they put extra pressure on the bladder, and that helps them empty further.
Yeah.
And so certainly position does have something to do with it. And like you were saying, incomplete voiding, as we call it, or just not emptying the bladder completely has a number of problems associated with it. One is it does increase your risk a little bit of infection, because if the urine sits around there, it has more...
You don't want it to hang around. You want to get rid of it. Yeah.
No, exactly. And then the other is, like you were saying, getting up at night, you know, I mean, if you can only empty your bladder incompletely, it's going to fill up faster and you're going to have to wake up at night, and it's an annoyance.
Yeah. All right. If you have a comment or a question for Dr. Zach, he's here for the next 30 minutes. Here are the numbers, 416-360-0740 or 866-740-4740.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Goldhawk Fights Back for You on AM 740 Zoomer Radio. Goldhawk Fights Back for You airs Monday to Friday, 11 to 1 on AM 740 Zoomer Radio.
Dr. Zach is here with his medical help and advice at 416-360-0740 or 866-740-4740. Joseph is on the line from Chatsworth. Joseph, what's your question?
Well, this may be the answer. I think it was about 3 weeks ago when a lady, I believe it was, phoned in about her TMJ.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I used to take ultrasound and whatnot when the government stopped paying for the treatments. I start chewing gum, and I'm fine. I'm in my 86th year.
Chewing gum, that's all that's all it took?
That's right.
Wow.
Well, whatever works, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Joseph, thanks very, very much for that. Wouldn't it be great if you could just chew gum and get rid? That's a, TMJ is a hugely painful thing for lots of people, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's quite common, and it's, you know, it's, the TMJ syndrome is basically anything that causes pain in the joint there, right at the top of your jaw. And obviously we use that joint a lot, anytime we speak, anytime we chew. And some people have chronic pain with it, and there are many different causes of it. And so that's why there are many different treatments for it, including splints and pain relievers, obviously, nighttime biofeedback. And there are also these there are dental like splints that can be used as well, and crowns, etc. So it may not work for everyone, but it sounds like Joseph found a nice solution for
we'll
him.
We'll add gum to the list, at least for some people, maybe.
Absolutely.
All right, here's Bill calling from St. Jacobs. Bill, what's your question?
Yeah, I had prostate cancer in 1998, and I was incontinent, and I went to Sunnybrook Hospital and had a mechanical sphincter installed, which is still in since 1998. And I can't understand why, 1999, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I can't understand why a lot of people who have the radical prostate are still using diapers, or the doctors don't know anything about it.
A mechanical sphincter.
Yep.
What? I don't know anything about that. I'm a mere mortal. What about? What do you say to that, Dr. Zach? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, you know, I've heard of it. It's Bill's absolutely right, though. I think a lot of people haven't heard of it, and even fewer of us necessarily know the indications for it. Because, as Bill's mentioning, unfortunately, a lot of people do have incontinence after a prostatectomy, after a radical prostatectomy.
Yeah.
And there are now one of the reasons it doesn't. It's not always a sphincter problem. So the sphincter is a valve, right, that basically keeps the urine from going from the bladder out through the urethra into the outside world.
Yep.
And sometimes it's there are other causes aside from a sphincter problem as a cause for the incontinence. So, but I think that Bill's right in that a lot of people who do have sphincter problems don't get referred properly for a mechanical sphincter. Now, if there are other things that caused it, like nerve problems, or any kind of nervous system problem, it doesn't necessarily respond to the mechanical sphincter, and so unfortunately it wouldn't work for them. But I think it is an important point that he's making, that there is treatment available.
There may be remedies beyond diapers. I think that's what Bill's trying to say.
Yeah, yeah. And it can be used in men or women.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's strictly mechanical.
Yeah.
It's got a balloon and a reservoir. I just squeeze my testicle 3 times, and I have 3 minutes of urination.
Just
and
like that.
And it's been in there since 1999.
No problems.
Yep, no problems.
All right, Bill, thank you very much. I was not aware that such a thing existed. Here's Vince. Go ahead, Zach.
I'm glad that Bill brought it up. I'm also glad that he brought up women because, you know, we've been talking mostly about men. But
yeah,
women often have very commonly the opposite problem. Men have a lot of problem with the urinary obstruction, so trouble getting the urine out, whereas much more common in women is urinary incontinence.
Yeah.
And so, and incontinence is and Bill was talking about incontinence because he had prostate surgery, and that's the most common cause of urinary incontinence in men, whereas in women, urinary incontinence is much more common even if they've had no surgery.
Yeah.
And depending on the type of incontinence, it's very often related to childbirth and pregnancy and menopause, and the urine they have more difficulty keeping the urine in.
Yeah.
And so the sphincter is often the problem, and having a mechanical sphincter is one treatment that's available.
All right, here's Vince now on the line from Toronto. Vince, what's your question?
Hello, I have a urinary infection. I've been taking an antibiotic called Keflex. It makes me dizzy. And in the past, I've been given antibiotics, which didn't seem to really do away with it. It's just an E. coli infection. Is there an antibiotic which you recommend that
doesn't make you dizzy, I guess is what you're saying,
yeah,
right?
It has a minimum side effect and that actually, you know, works.
Absolutely. Okay, so thanks for the question. I mean, basically, so urinary tract infections, it's worth noting, are very, very common. If they're happening repeatedly, it's worth seeing a urologist to see, you know, usually there's some kind of cause and often there's a way to prevent it. Now, in terms of what treatment, the first line treatment is antibiotics because you need to treat the bacteria that's causing it. And it sounds like Vince does know the bacteria. E. coli is a very common cause of infection for urinary tract infections. In terms of which antibiotics, I mean, certainly the first line ones that we tend to use are things like Cipro or ciprofloxacin and Ceftra, but Keflex and Clavulin and Amoxicillin are useful as well. And you know, in general, dizziness is not one of the typical side effects, but it's really individual. Some people do have those side effects. I should say that in your particular case or in anyone's particular case, it sounds like you had this, you had a culture done. So basically they take the urine, they check what bacteria, and then they do a test to see what antibiotic that bacteria is sensitive to, because there's often resistance to some antibiotics. So I can say to you, oh, Cipro is a good antibiotic, but they may have in your results, they may say this E. coli is resistant to Cipro, and so there's no point in you taking that.
Yeah.
So basically what you have to do is find out from your doctor what medications it's sensitive to, and then, and most likely, very, very often it's sensitive to a number of medications. So if the Keflex is making you dizzy, I would bet that there's another antibiotic that the bacteria is sensitive to that won't make you dizzy. So, but you do need that information, because otherwise it's really just you can guess, because like I said, often Cipro and Ceftra are very effective, but the best is to have a urine culture and sensitivity to know which antibiotics you can actually choose from.
All right, Vince, I hope that helps. And as you often say, Dr. Zach, when you're on some kind of medication and for various reasons it's not the right medication, there's usually always a choice or two, right?
Absolutely. You know, and we do talk a lot about resistant antibiotics, and that's a big concern. But usually there are a number that you can choose from. And I think I should bring up one thing because it was in the information that was on the website that you put up. and I think it's worth addressing just in case anyone's heard about it and is worried about it, is that these prostate, there's a few prostate cancer medications that they were studying to see if there was, to see if actually they could decrease the risk of prostate cancer. And they found that, there are medications that are used for benign prostate hyperplasia, not for prostate cancer.
Right.
And they found specifically for finasteride, which is Proscar, which is pretty common, that actually there was a small decrease in the amount of low-grade prostate cancer, but there was some association with an increased risk of a high-grade prostate cancer. So those medications right now are not recommended. They're certainly not recommended to use to try and prevent prostate cancer. They're useful for this BPH, benign prostatic hyperplasia, but they don't prevent prostate cancer, so they shouldn't be prescribed for that reason.
Okay, here's Stan calling from St. Catharines. Stan, what's your question?
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi.
I'd like to ask the doctor to comment on something. Like, I've been taking Proscar
yep.
it is, for the past couple of years, but then Health Canada came out about a couple of months ago saying that that could bring on cancer. What would your comment be on that, doctor?
Yeah, well, so I'm glad to reiterate this. So basically, Proscar, which is finasteride, which actually is also prescribed at a lower dose, and it's called Propecia. It's the same medication, but just a different dose. And Propecia is used for male pattern hair loss, male pattern baldness.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so they did a study with finasteride. The dose was 5 milligrams, and it was in men 50 years and older. And they were trying to see, actually, if it decreased the risk of prostate cancer. What they found was there was a small but statistically significant increase in risk of high-grade prostate cancer. There was a... It also did have decreased the risk somewhat of low-grade prostate cancer. But there is some increased risk of the high-grade prostate cancer. Now, it's not, unfortunately, I don't have, I actually have the numbers. I've been looking while I've been chatting, and here are the numbers I can tell you. For every 150 to 200 men taking finasteride or Avodart, which is in the same family, for prostate cancer prevention, between 3 and 4 low-grade cancers would be prevented, but one additional high-grade cancer would occur. So there is that risk. It's not a...
Well, it's hard to know whether or not you'd be ahead or behind on this then, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, so that's it. So, Stan, it's a dilemma, and it's something worth discussing with your doctor because there are some other factors at play, including if there's a family history of prostate cancer and including if you have other kinds of risk factors. And also to determine, you know, if this medication is really helping you for your urine flow and your risk of prostate cancer is quite low, then it may well still be worthwhile to take it, but to have very close follow-up with your doctor for any signs or symptoms, or if you get followed with a whole other issue that we've spoken about before with the PSA, whether that's worthwhile.
Yeah, well,
but it's not, unfortunately, it does exist now that we know that there is a small increased risk of these high-grade prostate cancers, and you have to be aware of it and discuss with your doctor if that little risk is worth the benefit to you.
Because of your own particular circumstances. Stan, thank you very much for your call. Dr. Zach will be here for the next few minutes. If you have a question for him, 416-360-0740 or 866-740-4740.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Goldhawk Fights Back for You on AM 740 Zoomer Radio. Goldhawk Fights Back for You airs Monday to Friday, 11 to 1 on AM 740 Zoomer Radio.
At 12:49, Dr. Zach is here answering your questions. Let's hear from Marge calling from Newmarket. Marge, what's your question?
My question is, is there any hope for a female who's been on a self-catheterization for 4 years for the bladder to reactivate in some way?
Dr. Zhang?
Well, thanks for the question. So so self-catheterization is basically one method that people use for, it can be used actually for either. If there's urinary incontinence, it can also be used if there's some urinary obstruction, so difficulty getting the urine out. The answer to you is, I always say that there's hope. It depends. What you need to know, what I would need to know, is more details in terms of what the cause is. Is it because, Marge, do you know if it's because of like an atonic bladder, that the bladder doesn't contract, or do you know what the cause is?
The muscles in the bladder stop working.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So that's one of the most common. I mean, basically, it's a very complex interplay because we need some muscles to contract and some muscles to relax to get the urine out. The bladder muscle has to contract, and then the sphincter, the valve there, has to open up. And so if you have any problem with those things, and it sounds like in this case the bladder isn't contracting, then the urine doesn't come out. I would certainly say there is hope. I would imagine you've probably seen a urologist already, the urologist being the expert in this field, because there are, depending on what the cause of the atonic bladder, there are either medications, or sometimes there are even nerve stimulation devices if it's a problem with the bladder not getting enough innervation from the central nervous system to actually contract. So in a very general way, I'd like to tell you that there is hope, but you do need to see a urologist, a specialist, who can determine exactly what the cause of the problem is, and then try something out.
Well, and of course, new developments, new methods of treatment do happen from time to time, and that might be part of the reason for having a little bit of hope, right?
Absolutely, and I think it's always worthwhile. It's always worthwhile to follow up with a specialist in the field, because, like you're saying, you know, even if it has been many years, it sounds like Marge has been doing this for many years, things do change, and if there are new treatments available, and if they do determine exactly what the primary cause is, they can certainly try something, absolutely.
Thanks, Marge, very much. Here's Julie in North York. Julie, what's your question?
Oh, hi, Dr. Zach.
Hi.
I'm a woman of 76, but I've had this problem. I was been going to bed and getting up to go to the washroom about 7-8 times a night, and I've had. I had to have my urethra dilated.
Okay.
And how many times can you have this done?
Well, there's certainly no. There's no maximum. That's the short answer.
But as I get older, I've had it done. A month ago, I had to have it dilated because the pain and everything.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, as I get older, is it still possible to get it dilated?
Oh, it's definitely still possible to get it dilated. I mean, you have to you'll have to sit down with your urologist and see exactly, obviously exactly what the cause is, and also determine if there's something you can do to prevent it from from becoming a little bit constricted again.
Well, he said it's like the tightness, so he has to dilate it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's very painful when you have to go to the washroom 7 times a night,
Oh, absolutely.
And then after that, I sort of get pain after that.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it. Now, do you know if you have any bladder spasms or any kind of urge? Because some people also, if you're going that often, sometimes there's also a factor of urge, overactive bladder, as we call it. So where the bladder.
Well, I know one time when I've been going to a urologist for 15 years, and he gives me some pills, but I'm going to a new urologist,
yeah.
And he put a camera and everything, and he said my bladder was fine. It's just the urethra.
Oh, I see.
And it's kind of like nobody knows how painful it is when you have to go, but it won't come out.
Oh, absolutely.
It's very painful.
Well, let's hope that with your new doctor, things will get a little better.
Well, I hope so. I want to go and have fun.
Yeah,
absolutely.
All right. Okay, Julie, thanks. Thanks very much for your call. Here's Delroy calling from Toronto. Delroy, what's your question?
Hi.
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 Is there a hospital in Toronto that does a laser surgery?
Oh, that does this laser prostate procedure?
Yeah.
Dr. Zach, are you aware of where that is being done now?
No, but I have absolutely no doubt. It would be very easy to find out. I can find out, or I can look into it, because there's absolutely no doubt. I mean, I know that the major and probably the minor hospitals here in Montreal are doing it, and I have absolutely no doubt that a number of hospitals in the Toronto area are doing it. So, you could even look it up on the internet, or just contact, you know, your family doctor.
Well, any family doctor would be aware of it, or at least would send someone to, I guess, a urologist who would know about it, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and they're not making any secret of it, and more is being used.
All right, thank you very much, Delroy. Here's Tony calling from Don Mills. Tony, what's your question?
Hi, Dr. Zach.
Hi.
Hi, my free PSA is 2.2.
Okay.
My PSA is 7.
Okay.
Should I take a biopsy? And what do you think of a free PSA test?
Yeah, so anyway, I mean, it's worth, I'm glad you brought it up, because PSA is something that we discussed many times.
Yes, we have.
And, you know, basically, PSA is the prostate-specific antigen, and it's very debatable as to whether it should be used as a screening test, but it does. Yeah. It is something that goes up with prostate cancer. And basically, the normal range, just so people know, the normal range is basically 0 to 4. And in men, who have a level, this is the total, between 4.1 and 9.9 who had a biopsy, 70% of them do not have prostate cancer. So it's important to note that there are other causes. And it's also important to note, as Tony's bringing up, that free PSA, there's more free PSA with benign conditions. So there's different types of PSA, and they're also looking at different types of PSA.
Confusing, I think, for ordinary mere mortals, Dr. Zach.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, it's something you definitely have to discuss with your doctor. I mean, once you do the test, you're stuck with the result. And I think knowing that you have a high PSA, a biopsy is not a totally benign procedure. There's some risk of bleeding. There's some risk of infection. But on the other hand, you have this result of an elevated PSA. And, you know, looking at your family history, looking if you have any symptoms, you know, talk to your doctor. It may be worthwhile for you to just go ahead and get the prostate biopsy at this point, because, you know, it's one of the important things about doing any test is you have to consider what you're going to do with the result of it. And now you have the result. So will you be comfortable with an elevated PSA? The other option, of course, is to repeat it if you think there might be another cause, because if you've had prostatitis, if you've had recent sex, if you've had a cystoscopy, any catheterization, those will all increase your PSA. So sometimes your doctor will say, let's repeat it. Let's see if it's
going to make sure
prostate cancer won't go down.
Dr. Zach, why is it that my doctor told me that the free PSA test is more important than the total PSA? And that I should not be worried if it's 2.2.
Well, basically, if your total is high, but most of it is not free, so in your case, you're 2.2, so it's not quite the majority of it, but it's a significant amount is the free PSA. So I'm saying that the more free PSA you have, the less likely that it's something that is a cancer. Of course, that doesn't rule it out completely. And so the reason it's useful to do both the free and the total PSA is that having a fair amount of free PSA does mean that your total PSA is more likely to be from something benign. But unfortunately, it still doesn't tell you 100%.
Yeah.
So you have to look at your individual case.
So you're saying I should take a biopsy?
That's a tough one, Tony. I think you should discuss with your doctor your personal risks and then decide with him if it's worth it to you. You know, I think if there's any concern and if you do have any symptoms or any family history, then it may well be worth getting a biopsy to put your mind at ease.
But that's a discussion, Tony, to be having with your own doctor. It's pretty hard for Dr. Zach over the telephone to be able to know. Though,
yeah.
Because the situations can be so different, can't they?
Absolutely, you know, and I need really your doctor, and what I would need is to have all the information at hand and also to have a discussion with you about any symptoms and what your preferences are to make that decision.
All right, Dr. Zach, totally out of time. Thank you once again for all the great information.
Thanks, Dale. Talk to you soon.
Okay, bye for now.
Bye.
Goldhawk Fights Back for You airs Monday to Friday, 11 to 1 on AM 740, Zoomer Radio.